Let me first say that my main qualification for being here is I was the second director of this institute. And I was also the fourth director of this institute, perhaps the only person who has done two terms as director of this institute. That is the main qualification for my being here. And my second qualification, which also not mentioned, is I've been in journalism from 1992 to 2004 for 12 years as consulting editor of various papers, but particularly of Times of India for about 10 years. Now today I'm going to talk about grand strategy for India. Actually, this term, so far as we are concerned, India is concerned, is being used only very recently. If you read earlier our history or our strategic literature in the earlier period, you won't come across the word that India had such and such a grand strategy. So, but that does not mean that India did not have a grand strategy. India did have a grand strategy, but that word was not used by people. It has started being used only very recently, and that too by very few people. It is still to acquire adequate currency among the strategists as well as foreign policy people. Therefore, what is grand strategy? Grand strategy is the kind of policy a nation pursues in overall in order to secure its national interest and national security. It's a kind of overall strategy, not in terms of day-to-day things, day-to-day reactions to events, or even short-term tactical moves a nation makes in terms of its relationship with other nations. These are all tactical things. Grand strategy is the overall concept which a nation has, that is the direction in which it should move or it should pursue in order to secure its national interest and its national security. Now, what was India's grand strategy from 1947? At that time, the grand strategy of India is something which many people today confuse with movement and as ideology, but it was really a strategy, that is what was called non-alignment. When Jawaharlal Nehru formulated non-alignment, it was actually a strategy, a grand strategy for India. Now, in order to formulate a grand strategy, a nation must visualize and have an understanding how the situation in the world is going to develop and how that developing situation will impact on its interests and on its security. It is only what you call a nation develops a world view about how the international security situation is going to develop and how that international situation is likely to affect it, then it would be able to formulate for itself a grand strategy. Now, it so happens that Jawaharlal Nehru visualized a world view And it held till 1990, that he visualized the world view at the beginning of the Cold War. And he formulated his grand strategy to meet the imperatives and compulsions of the Cold War. And therefore, that strategy, grand strategy, held good for the Cold War period. Once the Cold War ended, of course, you are going to change your strategy because the situation in the world has materially altered. And when the situation in the world gets materially altered, then of course you have got to alter your strategy in order to adapt it to the needs of the situation. And therefore you can say we have been trying to evolve a grand strategy since the end of the Cold War in 1990, but in fact it is still under evolution, because the post-Cold War world is still evolving, and therefore we are still looking at the situation, and our grand strategy in that respect is also evolving. I will explain it. But first, let's go back to the grand strategy which India had from 1946 to 1990, which is 44 years, which is a fairly long period of time for any nation to have a grand strategy. That is because very rarely you get a period in history in which the global situation remains unaltered over a period of time. People used to say from 1815, the Congress of Vienna after the defeat of Napoleon, till 1914, the situation in Europe was more or less unaltered in any major way, and therefore that was considered a period or a century of peace, and that was the period they used to talk about the grand strategy of nations in terms of balance of power. Now, in our case, in 1946, the World War had ended, and two major nations emerged victorious from that World War. One was the United States, at that time the richest and most powerful nation on earth, and the nation which decided to rebuild the war-torn world, and therefore they helped to rebuild Europe and tried to help also the rest of the world. And then opposed to that was a second nation which was also a victor of the World War, actually the nation which finally captured Berlin, the capital of Germany, that was Soviet Union. The problem between the two nations at that time were, even though they were allies during the war, the Soviet Union propagated the ideology of Marxism. And that is to say that the market economy and capitalism were not good for the people, and people should adopt Marxism, or they said socialism, moving towards communism. That should be the political philosophy, economic philosophy the world should adopt. And according to them at that stage, they all felt the history was moving in that direction. It was inevitable that would happen, and therefore they were on the right side of history, they will get it. On the other hand, the Americans felt that the right thing for the world was market capitalism, and therefore they should oppose the communism, and they should prevent communism from expanding itself, and that was the beginning of the falling out between the two major powers of the world who were the victors of the Second World War. The result of that was Europe got divided in the middle, and you had Eastern European nations under the control of the Soviet Union, accepting the state-controlled economy, and you had all the Western European nations which followed the market economy. Now, normally, this situation would have resulted in a world war. But it did not result in the world war because by that time, nuclear weapons were developed by both initially by United States, followed within 4 years by the Soviet Union. And both countries realized that if there was a war and nuclear weapons were used, then there would not be, that realization came much later. Initially, of course, they thought that you could fight a nuclear war. But anyway, they knew fighting a nuclear war would mean enormous damage. Of course, finally, they came to the conclusion you cannot win a nuclear war. But that waited till 1985. Therefore, we had at that stage two power blocks in the world, one communist, the other the capitalist market economy. At the same time, the market economy also practiced democracy, while the communist countries practiced what you may call the Communist Party directed one party state. Now, in 1946, when India became free, or rather 47, when India became free, the problem before India is what kind of policy or what kind of grand strategy it should adopt in this. Now, we had a problem in this country. One problem, of course, was the country was divided by partition by the British, and British did it mainly because they felt that Britain and the Western powers would have a foothold in India if it was partitioned and there was Pakistan. The second problem we had was, and that produced enormous refugees, and India faced the problem of rehabilitating them, all those things. But the second problem we had was, the communist parties of the world at that time believed that they should carry out revolution in various countries where there was no revolution, where the countries were not communists. And in 1946, they had a secret meeting in Calcutta of the Asian Communist Parties, and they decided that in various Asian countries, the Communist Parties will rise and will have, will try revolution in all these countries. Indian Communist Party also did that. And they had already started insurgencies in India in various states. One of the biggest insurgencies was in Telangana. Maoism in Andhra is not new. It started off in 1948. There were, you may say, some kinds of minor insurgencies in Kerala, where, of course, there was a strong Communist Party. You had it in Bengal. So the problem the new government of Nehru faced was you had to face insurgency in India, communist insurgency in India. And there the problem was China was having a revolution and the Chinese Communist Party came to power. China became a communist country. Soviet Union was already a communist country, and that too a victorious power. Now, for Nehru, the problem is you had a problem within the country of the communist insurgency. And you had a problem of Western powers having created a Pakistan, mainly because they wanted to use Pakistan as a kind of base for prosecuting the war, or rather Cold War. At that time, they didn't know it was going to be a long Cold War against Soviet Union. So, under these circumstances, he decided the right thing is not to join either of the two blocs. And tried to take decisions on each issue on the basis of India's national interest. That's why it is not called neutrality. It is called non-alignment. We don't align ourselves with either of the two blocks. But then, he also wanted to do something. He sensed that the right thing is if he can befriend Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was not so much interested in creating revolution in India. Actually, the country which was very much interested in creating revolution in India at that time was China and the Chinese communists, Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai, and others. And so far as the democratic countries are concerned, he was reasonably confident that the democratic countries would not pose a national security threat to India. But if the Communist Party started supporting the communists in India, then you will have a major problem on your hand. Therefore, he decided the right thing is to be non-aligned, at the same time started slowly befriending the Soviet Union. Of course, after 5-6 years, he also realized, in spite of their being, both of them being communist countries, the Soviet Union and China were not really friends. They had problems between themselves. And then he also sensed your problem is going to be with China. Soviet Union is going to have problems with China. Therefore, the right thing is Soviet Union and yourself had some common interests, security interests. So from the very beginning, of course, he sent his sister as the first ambassador to Soviet Union, and then he sent Professor Radhakrishnan as the ambassador. Of course, Mrs. Vijayalakshmi Pandit did not succeed in her mission, but Dr. Radhakrishnan did succeed in meeting Stalin and talking to him, etc. Therefore, we had this process of non-alignment, trying to befriend Soviet Union. And in any case, the other democracies they also regarded India as a democracy. And therefore, you try not to alienate either of the two. And we also had a problem of the Pakistanis getting into Kashmir. And when the matter went to the UN, the Western powers, because they had an interest in Pakistan as a base, trying to side with Pakistan on the Kashmir issue. Therefore, you had to have somebody to balance that. So, again, that would explain why he felt he had to be friendly to Soviet Union. That was the origin of non-alignment and the, you may say, the policy of not siding with either of the two on the Cold War. Of course, you may hear people talking about non-alignment as a great movement, it's a great ideology, it was meant for all the developing nations, this, that, and all. All that happened after Nehru. Nehru, when he formulated this, it was a strategy, it was a grand strategy for India to secure India's interests in terms of political interests like Kashmir and India's security, because he sensed that there was a commonality of security interests with Soviet Union because of China. Then it turned out he was absolutely, he sensed things very rightly, because in 1962, when the Chinese attacked us on the basis of the border dispute, of course the Western powers said they would give us aid. But after some time, the Pakistanis put pressure on them, saying, no, 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 you cannot give aid to India. India will become too strong. And that would affect us. And therefore, the Americans started telling us, saying, we'll give you some aid, but we cannot give you combat aircraft, we cannot give you combat equipment, we cannot give you anything which is, we'll give you border road equipment, we will give you some factories and other things, but no combat equipment. But at that time, the fact that Soviet Union had commonality of security interests with us, it paid dividends. The Soviet Union said they were prepared to give us anything that we wanted. So when the West did not help us, even though at that time the West and the Chinese were enemies, but still, because of the Pakistani pressure, the West did not help us. At that time, we got all the help from the Soviet Union. So the grand strategy of non-alignment paid dividends. Then came 1971. At that time, we had the crisis in Bangladesh, when the Pakistani army had killed about 1 million Bangladeshis and pushed out 10 million Bangladesh refugees onto the Indian soil. We had refugees in all the states around Bangladesh, West Bengal, Meghalaya, Assam, Tripura, Manipur. We had to accommodate and look after 10 million refugees. Therefore, I mean, could easily be anticipated that there was going to be a war. But at that stage, the Pakistanis helped to bring the Chinese and the Americans together, because the Chinese had already quarreled with the Soviet Union, even though it was a fellow communist country, a country which helped China to build industrially. In spite of that, they quarreled with the Soviet Union, and they even had a clash, an armed clash. And the Americans then decided to take advantage of it. So they more or less communicated to China, if you leave Soviet Union and come over to our side, we will help you in various ways. And the Chinese agreed. And this happened at the time when we had the crisis in Bangladesh. So, because we are non-aligned, we were able to do something. We were able to invoke the Soviet Union's help. We signed what was called a friendship treaty with the Soviet Union. Not a military pact, because we are non-aligned, we are pledged not to join either of the two parties in their Cold War. but we called it a friendship pact. But the Soviet Union was prepared to supply to you on a very urgent basis all the military equipment and hardware you needed. And the Soviet Union also at that time took steps to deter the Chinese and the Americans. The result of that was they were held back, and even when they tried to condemn us in the Security Council, the Soviet Union used its veto. And then after, they tried to frighten us by sending their Enterprise fleet. The Soviets took steps which would create uncertainty for the Americans. The result of that was we were able to finish the military operations, liberate Bangladesh. So then came the 1980s, when the Soviets moved into Afghanistan as a result of the request made by the Afghan government, which was then a communist government, that they were being harassed by Mujahideen, who were supported jointly by the Americans and the Pakistanis. The Soviet forces moved into Afghanistan. While the whole world condemned the Soviet Union, we did not. Because, of course, we owed so much to the Soviet Union. They had helped us earlier. So we did not do that. To that extent, of course, it did alienate the United States from us. The result of that was the United States rewarded the Chinese, the Pakistanis, who were with them in harassing the Soviets in Afghanistan and trying to throw them out. They allowed the Pakistanis to become a nuclear weapon power, getting the technology from the Chinese. So in the 80s, Pakistanis became a nuclear weapon power. But we had earlier conducted a nuclear test in 1974 because of our problem with China. The Chinese had become a nuclear weapon power in 1964, and you had at that time Mao Zedong, who was preaching a great cultural revolution, and he was preaching to the world, everybody has a right to have nuclear weapons. And he was trying to tell the world that the countryside will win over the cities. And of course, he turned on his own, all his colleagues, and liquidated most of them. So in those circumstances, we felt that we should have nuclear capability in order to deter the Chinese. That's why we had the 1974 nuclear test. Now, during this period, it was this non-aligned posture which helped us to secure India's, ensure India's security, and at the same time, we were getting, you may say, assistance from both blocks, economic and developmental assistance from both blocks. During the entire 50s and 60s, the Americans used to supply grain to us. At that time, India used to be short of food. And of course, the Americans helped us in our grain revolution, which of course made us be self-reliant in food. At the same time, we got major factories, industrial establishments, and other things with Soviet help. We also got all the necessary military equipment from the Soviet Union. So in that sense, the non-alignment as a strategy paid dividends you were able to get from both. All that came to an end when the Cold War ended, when the Americans and the Russians of the NATO and the Warsaw Pact sat together across a table and did something unprecedented in history. In all history books, you can't find an instance in which two blocs, which are armed to the teeth, which had capability to destroy the world several times over, and which were confronting each other eyeball to eyeball for 40 years, finally sitting across the table and making peace and agreeing to cut back the forces. That happened mainly because of the fact they came to the conclusion a nuclear war cannot be won and should not be fought. Now you have a totally different situation. And of course, immediately thereafter, the Soviet Union broke up because of its own internal contradictions. Communism didn't work, as it didn't work in China too. So under those circumstances, you had a new situation. You can't now count on Soviet help, because today Russia is not what Soviet Union used to be, a major power, and with enormous military capability. So you had to deal with a totally new situation. Now, at the same time, the rest of the world also calculated that the situation is a new situation and the Cold War is over. Therefore, even for the Americans, the use of Pakistan as a base for the Cold War, that also was over. So, one can say, on our side, we decided that we have to adjust ourselves to the new situation. And so did the Americans also decided they should also look for opportunities to adjust themselves to the new situation. Now, under those circumstances, all that first thing that happened in India's case, where you can say, a new grand strategy had to be formulated. The first thing that happened was we decided that we needed to reform economically. The result of that first was that communism as an ideology failed. Therefore, the state-directed planning by itself does not lead to economic growth as much as allowing market economy to operate. That kind of situation of a perception developed in India, and Manmohan Singh became finance minister, and he introduced all the reforms, economic reforms. He started introducing economic reforms under Narasimha Rao's government. And in order to adjust ourselves, we used to not to have ambassadorial relations with Israel, even though we recognized Israel, but we didn't have. Now we try to signal to various people in the world that we are changing direction. So we posted an ambassador to Israel. And we were trying to grope for whether we can improve our relations with the West. But here, one of the issues which we had to consider very carefully is the nuclear issue. We had carried out a nuclear test in 1974. And then we knew from 1979 onwards that the Pakistanis were making nuclear weapons and they were being assisted by China. Therefore, it became imperative for India also to go nuclear. Rajiv Gandhi, even though he tried very hard to preach disarmament and advocate disarmament in the UN, etc., etc., finally came to the conclusion that the world was not prepared for disarmament. And given the threat India faced, both from China and China-armed Pakistan, he had to go nuclear. So very reluctantly, finally, he decided to go nuclear. But then the whole question was, there was a treaty which said only five nations will be nuclear, and then the door has been shut, nobody else will become nuclear. We didn't join the treaty. But at the same time, the others wanted to close all our options. So they brought in Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. Now, up to that point of time, you were under pressure because we didn't have foreign exchange. We needed foreign aid. So under those circumstances, you had to be very careful in not offending other nations in the world. But once you introduced economic reforms, and India's economic growth started going up, and you started, instead of being short of foreign exchange, you started accumulating foreign exchange. And also we had 3 million, 4 million people working in the Gulf countries, sending in money. Therefore, by 1998, we had something like $60-70 billion of foreign exchange in reserve. So, then Indian Prime Minister decided, we can now afford to stand up to the rest of the world, they can't do anything to us, if we now conduct the nuclear test. So the nuclear test was conducted. Not because we believed in fighting a nuclear war, but because the rest of the world treated nuclear weapons as a currency of power. Therefore, you will have to keep up with the Joneses. And we had a missile program. So we did that in 98, and we knew that the Pakistanis will do it because they already had the Chinese tested nuclear weapons. So they followed suit. The rest of the world clamped sanctions on us. It didn't work out. Because we asked the Indian community to contribute to foreign exchange for us, and in no time we got some $6 billion. Every Indian outside, they contributed to the bonds, and therefore the rest of the world realized that you cannot now put pressure on India. That's because of the new economic policies pursued by India. At that stage, the Americans started changing their policy. So you had Bill Clinton coming here. Of course, before that, we had the Kargil War with Pakistan. Pakistanis felt that because they had nuclear weapons, we wouldn't be able to fight a major war, go into Pakistan. Therefore, if they fight a war on the border, they can seize some territory, and that will give them a lot of prestige and make Kashmir dispute an international dispute which will come up to the United Nations again. But we decided to fight that war, and the rest of the world decided to allow India to fight that war to the finish. And The Americans told the Pakistanis, you are wrong, you started the war. So finally we were able to push the Pakistanis back. Then we realized for the first time the Americans didn't side with the Pakistanis, which showed that the Americans were changing their policy. Then came 2000, Clinton visited India and spent 4 days in India. And while he spent 5 hours in Pakistan, which again was under military rule. So now there is a new situation in the world. How do we adjust ourselves to the new situation and formulate a grand strategy for this situation? That is today what is under evolution. So we should look at the whole world. The first thing we'll have to realize is, unlike in the Cold War period, there was a fear that there would be a war among the major powers. Now, most of the world agrees there will not be a war among the major powers. By major powers, I mean the 5 members of the Security Council and India. President Obama recently said, it's irony that while the risks of nuclear confrontation has come down, the risks of nuclear attack by terrorists has increased. So today, there is not fear that the major powers who are armed with nuclear weapons will go to war with each other, because war with nuclear weapons is unthinkable. You can't win that war. So if the major powers are not going to fight that war, secondly, because of the economic globalization, one country depends so much on another country for its own prosperity. For instance, China is very prosperous today, but it is prosperous because 15% of its GDP, gross domestic product, comes from its exports to other countries. Therefore, you can't fight a war. First of all, if you fight a war with the United States, they will lose all their exports. Two, if you fight a war, it will affect your oil trade, your oil coming in. And lastly, of course, is they have built so many cities and they can't risk it. So you find there is increasing realization that there would not be a war among major powers. But that does not mean there would not be wars. There can be wars between major and medium power, as between the United States and Iraq, United States and Afghanistan. There can be between Pakistan and India. That is possible. And therefore, the major powers, again, out of the 6 major powers we have in the world, 5 are democracies. Only one power is not a democracy. That is China. Therefore, there is, you may say, an ideological divide between the democratic powers of the world and the non-democratic China. Thirdly, if you look at it, China, which was a developing country, has developed so fast. It is today almost the 2nd GDP in the world. And it is growing so fast that it is expected in the next 20 years or so, China will become the number 1 GDP in the world. Of course, India is growing fast. Therefore, the next 20 years or so, India will become the 3rd GDP of the world. the United States may drop from first GDP to the second GDP. Now, under these circumstances, in a world situation in which you don't expect major wars among powers, I mean, you would have heard various people coming and telling you, we have a security problem with China. Yes, we have a security problem with China, but that is not going to be a security problem of India and China fighting a major war using all its forces. The Chinese will try to put pressure on us, will harass us, and we have got to find ways of preventing them from doing all that. And the Chinese will harass us more by helping the Pakistanis. Therefore, your problem will be Pakistan, your problem will be China. But at the same time, what does the rest of the world look at India? Now, there is a difference between India is now growing fast. It has become what is called one of the trillion-dollar economies. Your GDP now is more than $1 trillion. And as I said, people expect in about 20 years' time, we will be the third largest economy in the world. But there is a difference between the way in which all other major powers of the world grew as powers and India's becoming a major power. All other major powers of the world became major powers before they became democracies. If you take Britain, Britain became a major power during the Elizabethan time and after that. And the Industrial Revolution of Britain started in the 17th century. And if you look at the Britain becoming a democracy after the Third Reform Act of the Parliament, that was the end of 19th century. By that time, Britain was already a major world power. So also France. Germany, which has become a major power, became a democracy only after the Second World War. Russia became a democracy only after the end of the Cold War in 1992. China is still not a democracy. Japan became a democracy only after 1945 World War. Japan was already a major power before that. So, excepting for the United States, all other major powers of the world became major powers before they became democracies, and they become democracies afterwards. Even in the case of the United States, it was not a real democracy till 1965, even though it was established as a democratic state. For 200 years after their becoming a democratic state, they had slavery. I mean, 100 years they had slavery, 200 years the black people couldn't vote freely and in the United States. It happened only after 1965 Civil Rights Act. India is the one country in which we became democracy first and started developing as a power afterwards. The result of that is, in the perception of all other powers, they don't regard India's growth as a power, as a threat. Well, they regard China's growth as a power, as a threat. Reason is, China is not a democracy, India is. And you are not in the history, because it is something which you cannot prove or disprove, no democracy has attacked another democracy. And therefore, There is no fear of India becoming a threat to the world peace, while there is fear about China. So you have now two factors. One, there is no fear about India. There is fear about China. The second is, China is not a democracy, while India is a democracy. Therefore, all the major powers of the world look at India's growth as a power benignly, while they have worries about China's growth as a power. Now, given this world situation, number one, this is one aspect of the world situation. The second aspect of the world situation is, I mentioned, China will be growing, has become a second power of the world. It will try to rise and become the first power of the world, displace the United States as the first power of the world. I don't think the Americans like it. You would like it if you were in that position. Who would like to lose his position and become from number one to number two? Therefore, the Americans would like to keep their position as number one power of the world. Now, when the Americans want to keep their position as number one power of the world, they cannot do it in terms of GDP, because GDP depends upon the number of people you have and their earnings, and China has got four times the population of the United States. And therefore, China's growth will make China the number one GDP. But still, the Americans want to be the most preeminent nation in terms of technology, in terms of economy, in terms of finance, in terms of what you may call soft power. Now, the problem for the Americans is their population is 1/4 the population of China. And in 21st century, there is general agreement that knowledge will be the power, because you are not going to fight a nuclear war. Knowledge will be the power. If knowledge is going to be the power, it depends upon the nation's growth in terms of knowledge. How many engineers, doctors, technicians, it produces. Whether it is able to educate all its population, feed its population, look after their health. Now, here, in order to keep that lead, the Americans look around for partners. From our point of view, would he like to prefer a world which has got United States as a preeminent power, or would he prefer a world where China is the preeminent power? What would you all prefer if you are given the choice? I mean, you may say, no, we would prefer a world where the India is the preeminent power. But that is not going to be possible for next 50, 60, 80 years. Huh? If you are non-aligned, the power structure will not, you won't be able to influence it. The world order will be, your non-alignment doesn't influence that. So, answer is obvious. You would like the world to be democratic instead of being non-democratic. You would like the world, you would prefer a world where the English is dominant language rather than Chinese. Lastly, you would prefer a world where you are able to travel and interact with people more easily. Today you can take all your gods, go and establish and build a Balaji temple or a Meenakshi temple or a Ganesha temple in the United States. You can't do that in China. So under those circumstances, at least people would prefer a world which has got democratic values. Therefore, that should explain to you why, after about 50 years of, shall we say, the United States being unfriendly to us in terms of our foreign policy and security policy, the United States has turned friendly to us. Now, similarly, so far as we are concerned, what should be our grand strategy? Our grand strategy is, should get as much as possible from the world system for our fast growth, and ensure that democracy remains the system in the world. And lastly, to move up and grow rapidly so that your position improves in the world. That should be our grand strategy. Now, here in this respect, India has no adversary excepting two. One is Pakistan, the other is China. I won't say China considers you adversary, China considers you a rival. Because the Chinese feel you are also growing fast, you are also a country with almost an equivalent population. Actually, you will be exceeding Chinese population in the next 20, 30 years. Their population is aging and will start declining, while our population is young, it will start growing. And two, they consider your growth under democratic conditions as a challenge to their system of a single party directing the state. So you can, from that you can derive what India's grand strategy is going to be for the next 40, 50 years. Still we think there is going, if at all there is a change in the world economic security situation. The grand strategy has to be, of course you don't have to alienate China, but you will have to befriend all the rest of the democratic world. And two, we should try to use the world situation in order to grow as fast as you can. And thirdly, of course, you should try to help the Indians moving across to all parts of the world. Because the diaspora helps. And in order to allow all these things to be done, you have to ensure your security. We have already nuclear weapons as a deterrent. We are getting missiles as a deterrent. And you have got to keep up your military capability as a deterrent against anybody else trying any mischief against us. That has got to be done. So long as the rest of the world believes in that, you are going to accept that. But at the same time, you have got to enter into partnership with various major powers of the world so that you can step up your technological growth, because knowledge is going to decide the hierarchy of nations as well as your GDP. That is why you may say, when today's government pushes the right to education bill, of course it is meant for right to education, to see every child gets educated, but it is also a strategic measure. It is also part of a grand strategy, because you can't do all these things unless all Indians are educated, unless you make increase the scientific and technological manpower in India. The same is true whether it is health reform or it is the food reform. So they all go together. They are all part of a grand strategy. The grand strategy is that India has got to be move ahead using the international situation today, which is available, and of course doing our best to help in the, when you say India grows, that means the Indian population has got to be looked after. So in that sense, there is a very thin line between your internal governance and your external policy or your security policy. So that will be the grand strategy for the period